1789 was a perilous time for the newly formed United States. The first representatives of the new federal Congress arrived in New York City with little idea of how the nation's government would actually work. There were arguments underway over numerous issues from presidential power to national finance, as well as the idea of placing the nation's capital on the Potomac River. Author and historian Fergus Bordwick says this first Congress was the most important in America's history, with the country's fate riding on its decisions. His new book is The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. He joins us this afternoon to talk about why this Congress was so important and the lessons today's lawmakers could learn from it. Fergus, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure. How are you doing, Mark?
Doing very well, thank you. What got your attention in the first place? What did you decide to write a book about this first Congress?
Well, I think I can explain that two ways. One, some years ago when I was writing a book about the creation of our capital on the Potomac at Washington, D.C., I stumbled across the debates in the first Congress and realized that they were very little known, even though it was the watershed Congress that created the government. So I knew there was a lot more to look at. And then second, like many Americans, perhaps, I've been dismayed by the declining respect for government and for Congress in the United States. And I think we are paying already a high price for that suspicion of or even contempt for government in our own time. And I wanted to go back and look at what the founders had in mind when they made this thing we call the Congress.
Going back to that first Congress, what were the challenges that faced the country at that time?
Well, the country was barely a nation at all. It was really a collection of 11 sovereign states. In 1789, North Carolina and Rhode Island hadn't even joined the Union. They were, in effect, separate countries. The government had no reliable source of revenue. There were more than 50 different currencies in circulation. There was no permanent capital. The British threatened the country's security from the north and Indians on the west. And Southerners were suspicious of Northerners and Westerners of Easterners. There were very well-founded fears that the west, and the west of that time meant over the Appalachian Mountains, Ohio, for instance, Kentucky, and so on, that the West would break off into another country. Quakers and some others were demanding an end to slavery, while Southerners, secession if the government dared to tamper with slavery. And even many members of Congress doubted that the government would survive its birth. It was a very, very shaky beginning. George Washington, when he took the oath of office in 1789, rather famously at the time, it was noticed that his hands were shaking so hard he could barely take the oath of office, and that reflected everyone's nervousness at what was about to happen.
How much power did the executive branch have in those early days?
Well, interestingly, very little, actually. George Washington was inventing the executive branch of the presidency as he went along, just as Congress was inventing its role. But at the time, Congress, the legislative branch, was regarded as by far the most important, the most central branch. Our perception of the presidency as the central, most powerful part of government really dates from the 20th century, and I think probably primarily from the 1930s and Franklin Roosevelt's forceful presidency. And nobody in 1789 thought of a term like the imperial presidency. Indeed, James Madison was concerned more than anything else to try to bolster the authority of what he considered the weakest branch of government, and he meant the presidency, to counter the near omnipotence of Congress. So it's quite different from our present time.
So George Washington was actually looking to Congress for leadership, not the other way around.
Yeah, very much so. That's exactly right. Washington did not come into office with an agenda, with a program for the first 100 days, so to speak. That's an anachronistic term coming from the 20th century. Indeed, no president until modern times came into office with his own agenda. Washington expected Congress to lay out what was necessary to move the country forward. of course, he had views. He certainly believed, and I think it's all to the good, in a strong presidency and a pretty strong central government. And there was a great deal of contention at that time over the power of the central government as a whole vis-a-vis the states, the anti-federalist movement was fairly significant.
Was Washington a little surprised and maybe even dismayed that they weren't taking his lead?
Well, broadly speaking, no, because he really believed in legislative government. He did not believe in an authoritarian presidency. And you remember that some years before the Constitutional Convention, officers in Washington's army, some of them, urged him to step up and become something like a military dictator, and Washington recoiled in horror. Washington was a genuine Republican. I mean, a small R Republican. He believed in a republic in which the legislature, the elected representatives, were paramount. Now, that said, he was terribly offended on a couple of occasions when he went to Congress expecting it to rubber stamp, in one instance, a treaty, and the other instance, an appointment. Congress decided to debate both those things, and Washington was very, very miffed indeed and stalked out of Federal Hall in New York City, which is where Congress was meeting, stalked out, saying, "I'm never coming back here again," or something to that effect, at any rate.
I am talking with Fergus Bordwick. His new book is The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government. Fergus, how did you do the research for the book?
Well, it took place over the course of a number of years, but I had the immensely valuable resource of something called the First Federal Congress Project. This is a very little-known but extraordinarily fine research project that's been underway since the 1950s under the aegis of George Washington University in Washington, D.C., and which over the course of these now 60 years has collected virtually every piece of writing known to have taken place during the First Congress or about the First Congress in its own time. There's a mountain of material, letters, diaries, not to mention official documents, that at present fills something like 22 very, very fat volumes. And it's a project that deserves to be much better known, and I hope in years to come will prove a very, very fruitful resource for other historians.
As you were doing all your research, what would you say was the most surprising thing you discovered?
One of the most significant things that was a surprise was the degree to which, no matter what their ideology was, and this is a Congress that was dominated by Federalists, people who believed in a more or less strong central government, and anti-Federalists, who were today what we call states' rightists. And they were not only Southern at that time. One of the most influential or articulate anti-Federalists was Elbridge Gerry of Massachusetts. The word gerrymandering come from his later term as a governor of Massachusetts. But at any rate, the degree to which all these men, and many of them were very ordinary, the degree to which they were committed to making this government work, even those who thought, frankly, the Constitution was a lousy idea, and they were there, like Elbridge Gerry, that it was a terrible idea. It was full of mistakes. They were very, very dismayed at the kind of government the Federalists wished for. As they went deeply into the battles that took place in the First Congress, and there were many, many, many. This was not a group hug. They weren't singing kumbaya. This was a Congress as contentious as any we have ever seen, including the present one. But nonetheless, the way they fought through to agreement, compromise, and we tend to think of compromise as a kind of maybe milk and water sort of drink. In fact, compromise is often quite brutal, hard to achieve, and leaves nobody feeling all that satisfied. Let's take Madison as an example, since he's such a towering figure. Men were willing to sacrifice not just pragmatically held positions, but deeply held convictions in order to get an agreement. And I think in our present day, there's a strain of thinking in this country, and it's always existed, that politicians should be absolutely pure and unbending to whatever their principles may happen to be. And that's not government. That's not government. That's not politics. The men who created the government, the founding fathers, knew politics was a process of deal-making, compromise, and sacrifice. And here you have James Madison, for example, who initially opposed any amendments whatsoever to the Constitution, staunch opponent of amendments, shifting very grudgingly and unhappily to proclaiming that he had always supported amendments, which he had not. And then once he was in a position, as he was in the first Congress, to, I would say, massage the many, 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 many proposed amendments down to a very small number, and ultimately we wound up with the first 10, that in the process of doing that massaging, he essentially undercut most of the stronger amendments. And we can see members like Madison again and others kind of down and dirty in the negotiations over where to put the national capital. And it was by no means a foregone conclusion it was going to be on the Potomac River.
Was that the most contentious issue they faced, Fergus, the whole idea of where to place the nation's capital?
Well, it was certainly one of them. The harshest debates were really over Alexander Hamilton's radical financial plan for the government. But tied to that was the debate over where to put the capital. And it was extremely sharp to the degree that at times Southern delegates threatened to secede, to walk out of the government if the capital was placed, particularly in Philadelphia, a hotbed of anti-slavery Quakers.
So this actually could have torn the country apart.
It could. That was seen as an immediate possibility. And hence, the capital that we have on the Potomac was the fruit of a compromise that did not leave everybody happy. It wasn't a simple decision at all.
That leads to the other question. Why was New York chosen as the site for this first Congress to meet?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is a bit amusing, which is to say, first Congress wound up there because everybody was tired of meeting hither and yon. During the previous period, known as the Confederation period, 1780s, Congress, which was a very different Congress, bear in mind, that Congress represented the states, and votes took place by state. There was only a handful of voting blocks. Each state was a block. At any rate, there was no national capital, and so Congress was sort of migratory, venturing from Philadelphia to Princeton, New Jersey, to Annapolis, and here and there, and everybody was sick of traipsing around, and they wound up and settled in New York because they just didn't want to go anywhere for a few years. So the Confederation Congress had already been meeting in New York, and that's why the Federal Congress, the first Congress, the one that I write about, remained there. And the government might have remained permanently in New York City. There was a strong and articulate lobby for New York, Alexander Hamilton, among others. Bear in mind, he wasn't in Congress, but he was very influential. And there were other advocates who were very, very powerful for several different locations in Pennsylvania. The most likely one would have been not Philadelphia, actually, but on the Susquehanna River near present-day Lancaster. Had the capital been put there, by the way, it never would have been burned by the British in 1814.
So what were a few of the other big accomplishments that this first Congress had?
There were so many that, you know, it almost beggars description. And as I've said in the book, I think unarguably this first Congress was the most prodigiously productive in spite of all the conflicts we've been talking about. Okay, so they created the first revenue stream for the government. Bear in mind, before the first Congress, the government consisted of about as many people as you could fit into sort of a large bathroom. Mm-hmm. Or a small parlor, perhaps. There was no federal bureaucracy. There were almost no full-time employees. So the first Congress created a revenue stream based on duties imposed on imports. In other words, a type of taxation. They were very careful not to impose direct taxes on the public, even though there were those who argued that that would be necessary, because Americans are even then so even violently tax-averse that government decided not to take the risk. The financial system that underpins the government was established. As I said, it was very, very contentious. It was the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton, who became the first Secretary of the Treasury. And essentially, he crafted a way of structuring the government's finances that embraced the principles of capitalism based on government borrowing money and using debt as leverage to borrow more money, which is the system that remains today and was very controversial at the time, but it was absolutely transformational. It was considered radical, and in bear in mind, too, that almost nobody in Congress or out understood the elementary principles of economics and finance. And that self-admitted ignorance comes into the debate a great deal with members saying, well, we don't really understand this thing called finance, but maybe it's a good idea.
So they were quite productive. Yeah, you're right. Quite productive. Yeah. Do you think there are lessons today's Congress could get from that first Congress?
Yes, I do. I think it's incumbent on Americans to realize that the government we have, as it works today and sometimes not working all that well, is what the founders intended. Nobody from James Madison on down thought that government would operate smoothly, simply, without conflict and without anger. Okay, the system was envisioned as something that was going to be contentious, slow, and difficult. We fail to appreciate how the machine actually was intended to operate. Okay, you know what about members of Congress? And I think we're in an era when there's a rather high degree of ideology that has made it more difficult for members to deal with each other in, I think, a productive way. I don't think anybody would really argue with that. Members of the first Congress were nearly all professional politicians. They weren't farmers who had just walked away from their plows. Most of them were lawyers. Most members have always been lawyers. But they believed in politics as a tool for national survival. And after all, I think the right to be political was what they fought the Revolutionary War for. And it was the engine that made Republican government work. So I think members today would be well advised to remember that public faith in democratic institutions is more important than any single ideological issue, and that patriotism does not lie in slandering and insulting Washington or attacks on the government in order to advance a partisan agenda. That undermines American values, and it betrays both the spirit and the intent of the founders. And in tough times, and times are always tough, so to speak, at least politically, in tough times, it takes experienced professionals, not amateurs, to shape the compromises that are always necessary to keep the country together and move it forward. And it doesn't just mean compromise on the small stuff, which is pretty easy, but it sometimes means sacrificing deeply held principles in the hope of prevailing another day. If you don't mind, I've got here a very short quote from Patrick Henry.
Okay, go ahead.
He was not in Congress. He was the militantly anti-federalist former governor of Virginia, and we all know him as a patriotic orator. And he was a kind of godfather to members of the Virginia delegation who were most hostile to compromise and to the Constitution. But he said, after the first Congress, he said, although the form of government into which my countrymen determined to place themselves had my enmity, yet as we are one and all embarked, it's natural to care for the crazy machine at least so long as we are out of sight of a port to refit. I like his referring to government as a crazy machine, and it often seems that way, doesn't it? And that would have been an apt title for my book, I think. But nonetheless, it's the machine we have, and it's the machine we made, and we ought to treat it well. We ought to treat it with respect, and we ought to all collaborate to make it work and not throw monkey wrenches into the gears, because that does not benefit us, and it is certainly hostile to the spirit of the founders.
Well, Fergus, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's been a pleasure.
Author and historian Fergus Bordwick, his new book is The First Congress, How James Madison, George Washington, and a Group of Extraordinary Men Invented the Government.